Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. Today we are here with Keith, and not only is he kind enough to interview for us, but he also invited me into his home to record. So thanks for doing this for us, Keith.
Absolutely.
And did you also know that we are recording at the same time General Conference is starting today?
I hadn't even thought of that.
It's a little ironic, isn't it?
I hadn't even considered that.
So we're having our own place of worship today. So Keith, let's start. Do you want to talk maybe a little bit about where your family comes in Mormon history anywhere?
Sure. I can't trace myself back to any big names. I don't get to be the ones like, my grandma was Hiram Smith's third, I don't have any of that. I do have a relatively famous pioneer ancestor who died on the way over here, and they marked her grave with a piece of metal that went around the wagon wheel and etched in it. Her name was Rebecca Burdick. And when the railroad was coming through, the surveyors came through and they altered the course of the railroad because this grave was a marked grave.
Wow.
And that's my big famous story. And I guess I'm related to the guy who the drummer boy on the back of one of the quarters or half dollars is based on, Gideon Burdick, I think is his name.
Oh, really?
And that's my most famous history stuff. Other than that, one of the questions I get asked a lot is if I'm related to a particular 70 who has the same last name as me. And I never am, because there's like this great big family with my last name, and then there's this rinky-dink family, and that's my family.
You're in the rinky-dink.
I'm in the rinky-dink family. There's this huge family, and they're relatively well-known that have my same last name. But that's not me. And people always ask me, are you related to so-and-so? I'm like, no. And then they go off about how wonderful it is, because he's this, 70 that everybody knows. And I'm like, great.
But I don't know him.
I don't know him. So...
So your family does go way back in pioneer history, though.
A little bit. I don't know where it all starts. I never knew. Like, I don't know any of the conversion stories. I haven't gone that back far into history. Mm-hmm. I know a whole lot about my parents because they wrote their life histories shortly before they died. And so, like, I know a lot about them, but I never really got into many generations beyond that. Like, I know my grandparents' names and my great-grandparents' names. My daughter's named after my great-grandmother. But outside of that, the stories we told growing up were never the, and we go back to this person who's a famous Mormon person, because I don't think we had one. I think my family probably comes from one of the no-names, but who knows?
Okay, so your parents grew up, raised you LDS, and
they did,
grew up
they
LDS.
Did. Yeah, my parents both did. My dad grew up in southern Idaho. My mom grew up in Park City. My dad's family moved to Park City when he was 13, 12, well, no, he was like 10. Then they met when they were 12 and 13, and they dated from that point forward, got married when they were 18 and 19, and away they went doing the Mormon thing. They had a kid almost immediately, and then within 11 years they'd had 7 kids, and I'm number 6.
Wow. But so, it wasn't really the Mormon thing, because they actually dated for a really long time.
Yes, they were only 12 and 13 by the time it was actually feasible for them to get married. They did. Mm-hmm. My dad was considering going on a mission, and so he had his money saved to pay for his mission, and instead he bought my mom a ring and they got married, and that ended up being a thing. Of so there's 3 girls and 4 boys in my family. There's the 3 oldest girls and then the 4 boys. I'm the second youngest, and I'm the only one of all of my brothers who actually went and went on a mission.
Oh.
I have an older brother who went and got about 4 months out and came home, and that's a whole other story. We don't need to get into that.
Yeah, but that's his story.
And then my other brother had to decide between getting married and going on a mission, and he got married, just like my dad.
Okay.
And me, I went on a mission. So,
did you feel a lot of pressure to go, or did you choose to go?
A little bit of both. It's kind of an interesting story. So when I was 18, about to turn 19, I decided I didn't want to go on a mission. It wasn't for me. I don't want to do this. And I told my family that at some family gathering, somebody made an offhand comment like, are you getting ready to put in your papers? And I said, I don't know. I don't think I'm going to go. And everything just exploded. You'd think the world had ended. I thought it wouldn't be a big deal because, my older brother had been sent home, and my other brother didn't go, and my younger brother certainly didn't look like he was going to go. And so I'm like, well, it's no big deal. But I was like the well-behaved child. So that meant that, of course, I would do all the right things. If nobody else did the right thing, me and my oldest sister, we'd do the right things, right?
You're kind of the only hope with the male missionary.
Sort of, yeah, because my dad hadn't gone, and my brothers had either not gone or not completed it. And then I had some brothers-in-law at that point who had gone, but nobody in my family had served a mission up to that point. And so, you know, if you could count on anyone, you could count on me, and I didn't want to do it. And then I got basically put in a room, and everybody who wanted to come lecture me about it took a turn lecturing me about it. And at the end of the day, my oldest sister told me that she didn't want me to go for me. She wanted me to go so her kids had an example, and that really laid the pressure on heavy. And then my brother-in-law, her husband, said, if you don't like it, just go home. He said, give it a try. See what you think. And I still didn't want to go, but I was like, if they leave me alone, I'll do it. And then I just figured, if I don't like it, I'll come home. And so I didn't really prepare as you're supposed to. I was doing stuff I shouldn't have been. I don't, you know, now it just seems so silly to be like, I was making out with my girlfriend, but that was something I shouldn't have been doing. Mm-hmm. But I just kept doing that up until I was set apart. And then I went into the MTC, and the first 4 days of the MTC are like this massive guilt ringer. Everything they talk to you about is designed to make you feel guilty about something you've done and have you come and confess and make sure that all of your sins have been cleared up with the proper priesthood authority and all of that. And so I'm feeling all this guilt. My MTC companion is going through pretty much the same thing, only he had gone way beyond in the boundaries of like law chastity and stuff than I ever had. He's telling me about how a week before he left for the MTC, he'd been sleeping with this girl and having to go get her the morning after pill the next day. And, you know, and I was just like, you know, doing your basic Mormon stuff. You know, I was making out with my girlfriend and there was that awful term petting, but I don't, you know, that sort of stuff was going on. But I just had a ton of guilt about it. And so I went and talked to the branch president in my branch at the MTC. And that started a series of interviews. I had to confess in detail the stuff that I'd been doing to, I want to say, about 6 different priesthood leaders. Wow. All at different times. So the branch president and the district president, and then 5. So the branch president in the MTC, and then the district president in the MTC, and then a member of the MTC presidency. And then I had to call my stake president and confess it all to him. And then I had to talk to my bishop and confess it all to him. And it happened that they were having a GA training at the MTC while I was there. And so the presidency went and asked, you know, their, whoever was over them, what to do about this missionary who this, that, and the other. And he said, just send him home. And so they sent me home from the MTC. And my parents didn't much care for that because it just looked like I was following the same trajectory as my older brother.
And that was the reason. Was your companion who sinned worse than you, did he confess? Was he sent home?
He did, because both of us were like in a ton of turmoil about it. And I felt so much better once I told somebody and he saw that I felt better. And at first he's like, I'm gonna power through. I can do this. I don't need to tell anybody. I can make this happen, you know. And I felt so much better. I'm like, oh, there's a weight been lifted off. And it's like, it's such bullshit. But after he saw that, he decided to go and do that. And we both got sent home at the same time.
Okay.
He was back out a month after me.
Wow.
Which was a little strange to me. But hey, yeah.
Just 30 more days later.
You know, at the time, I'm like, oh, so that's the difference. Like, you know,
Hmm.
30 days. How penitent were you? I was such a self-righteous prick as a missionary anyway, so.
Yeah, well, that goes with the territory.
So when they sent me home, of course, I'm like, you can't tell me I can't do this. And that's when I decided I really wanted to go. Hmm. And so I was home for 4 or 5 months. And
was that hard with your family?
My family was actually pretty cool about it. Good. My parents had a vacation planned, and I'm like, I don't want to mess up your vacation. Just go. They're like, we don't trust you. You're coming with us. And I'm like, okay. And actually that trip, I got to know my parents as people. And I don't know if everybody has this experience, but like growing up, your parents are your parents. And then you don't realize that they're just dumb people trying to, you know, fake their way through life just like everybody else. And I went on this trip with them, and they treated me like a grown-up for the first time ever. You know, they asked my opinion, where I wanted to go, and, you know, that sort of thing. It was really bizarre for me, being the second youngest, too, because it's just like, at some point, the parents are just like, oh, I'm not doing this anymore. Whatever, right? We're just going to do what we want to do. And so it ended up being a really great vacation. I got to know my parents really well, and that helped in the ensuing months, you know. And I had to meet with my bishop every week, and I had to break up with my girlfriend, and then I do everything. My bishop says I'm good, I'm clear. The stake president says I'm good, I'm clear, and he'll resubmit my papers. Well, we keep waiting. You know, 2 weeks pass, 3 weeks pass, 4 weeks pass, and my dad keeps asking the stake president, yeah, did you get those back? And he's like, oh, yeah, they're in. You know, you just got to be patient. You know, these things take time. And my dad got a little impatient, so he called up to Salt Lake and called the mission department. He said, hey, my son had this, what happened? You know, he got sent home. He's worked it through. And the stake president said he resubmitted his papers, but we haven't heard anything. And the mission department says, we haven't seen anything for your son. And so the stake president, who didn't like me and he didn't like my friends, he had kept my papers and then told us he had sent them because he didn't like me.
Hmm.
And next thing you know, the stake president just comes barreling at my dad at church and just starts screaming at him. How dare you go over my head? You can't do that. Everything must be, you've got to come to me if you've got a question. And my dad just was like, you weren't doing what you said. You lied to us, essentially. And apparently Salt Lake had called this stake president and been like, what are you doing? If this kid's ready, get his papers to us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he did, and I was just kind of hanging out, and you go into the MTC on a Wednesday. On Tuesday in the morning, we get this call saying, hey, you can come in tomorrow if you want.
Wow.
I'm like, I'm at work when this happens. So, you know, I have a job, and I'm, you know, doing all my normal stuff because I didn't know how long I'd be home, so I went back to my old job, and I'd already been through the first 4 days of orientation. I said, can you ask them, since I've already been through orientation, if I can come in on Monday so I can get all of my stuff taken care of because I've got to quit my job and I don't just want to disappear the next day, you know. And they said, yeah, that was fine. And so I spent the weekend getting ready. I don't know what that meant, making out with another girl for the last time. You know, it's like going into the desert. So anyhow.
I was guessing packing, but
no, hey. But... And
priorities.
So I reported. Yeah, that was always my thing. I reported to the MTC on a Monday, and I don't know that they were expecting me. So, well, no, they were, because I did have a companion. And so I did and the MTC provost sucks, you know. And I was part of a program. I went to Brazil, and so I was part of a program where we did half in Provo, and then they sent us down to São Paulo to do half there. This is in the late 90s, and the Provo MTC is the most god awful place in the world. It's the level of self-righteousness that exists there is just insane, and the backbiting and the, oh, you only got to be a leader because X. It's just like, I was a district leader in the MTC, and it's a glorified mail person. You have the mail key, that's it, you know, that's your responsibility, but everybody wants the mail key. And I had a bunch of people.
It's an extension of the priesthood keys, yeah, right?
Well, of course. They don't talk about it in the scriptures, but, you know, the male key is a key of the priesthood, apparently. Anyhow, and then we went down to São Paulo, and that was a really fantastic experience. But we were there over Christmas, and the idea is to immerse the missionaries with native-speaking missionaries. But there were no native-speaking missionaries there because it was over Christmas, and the temple was closed. And since Brazilian missionaries, I mean, there's not all, most of them don't live near a temple to do their endowment and such. They come to the MTC and they'll go through the temple for the first time when they come to the MTC there. And so we just got to hang out in this huge building. There's about 15 missionaries in this like 9-story skyscraper type building in the middle of the capital, in the middle of the biggest city in Brazil, in São Paulo. And it was just a really cool experience. It was a lot of fun. And then I went field and did my mission, and there was nothing more extraordinary about that. I served in the middle of nowhere, and I had a good time. That's one of those things I still don't regret, is doing that. It impacted me in a huge way, just because I grew up lower middle class in Utah, and I thought I was a pretty poor kid, but I didn't know what poverty was till I went to northern Brazil and saw people who have dirt floors and no electricity and whose houses have 3 walls and a tarp, because they haven't been able to scavenge the wood to build their 4th wall in their home. They all live in 1 room. They have 8 people living in a house that's the size of, like, my living room. You know, it's... When you see the world differently that way, when you look at somebody else's experience that's just so different than your own, but they're okay with it. You know, it's not like these people were scraping to, you know, get whatever it was I had. They were okay with it. If they could build that fourth wall, that would be awesome, and they were happy. It really caused a lot of a dissonance for me, because it's like, no, you've got to want what I want, and such. So, but I love Brazil. I was in a mission called the Manaus mission, and it was just enormous. We flew in airplanes for transfers, and there were transfers that would take you 2 days on boats, and it was really cool. And then I came home, decided I wasn't going to get married. I was going to be a rock star instead. And then I met my wife, and yeah, that whole situation ended.
She foiled those plans, huh?
She's pretty damn cool. I'm one of those weird guys who talks about his wife a lot, in terms of she's a remarkable person. And
I don't think that's weird. I think that's great. It's wonderful.
We did the typical Mormon. This is where the typical Mormon thing happens. We met 3 weeks after we met. We started dating. 5 weeks after that, we got engaged. And 3 months after that, we were married.
Wow.
So we had no business getting married. We had no idea who the other person was. We didn't know each other. And
how soon was this after your mission?
About a year.
A year. Okay.
I was wanting to wait till I was 27. I wanted to go live out the back of cars and eat tuna fish off of saltine crackers and play my music. And looking back, it's like, I'm pretty glad I didn't do that, because I've really enjoyed being married to my wife. And we've been married for a little over 12 years now. It's been 13 years now. So it's worked out. We got 4 kids, and we actually waited to have kids for a couple of years, and I think that was a really smart thing to do, because we didn't know each other. You know, we waited 3 years. We were married for 3 years before we got pregnant with our first kid, and that was good, because I have friends who've had kids right away, and then they find out that they don't like each other. And that is not just that they, you know, aren't in love with each other. They don't like each other as people. And I don't know that you want to be married to somebody that you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of get stuck, or you put your kids in that situation. I have a friend who had honeymoon twins, and he was down at school in Cedar City, and he came home one day, and his wife had just moved out, taken the kids and gone back up to Ogden to live with her family. Didn't even tell him. He just got home, and all her stuff and a bunch of their furniture was gone. It's just like, it's insanity. But anyhow, and then we were married for quite a while.
Oh, and you were married in the temple.
Okay. We got married in the temple. My wife wanted to get married in the San Diego temple, and I'm like, my family can't afford to all go out to San Diego, I said. But we compromised, and so she went through for her first time in San Diego, and she and I went out there with her parents. That was right at the time my mom got diagnosed with cancer, so she was going through her first round of treatments, and she could either come to San Diego for the endowment with my wife, or she could stay, have a treatment, and then be well enough to come to our wedding the following January. So she stayed home, my dad stayed home. So I just went with her and her parents. She went through the San Diego Temple, which is a really cool temple. You know, it's got this big grand staircase and the celestial room and like an atrium, you know, because it's in San Diego, so it's got to be a little different and, you know, special and what have you. So we got married and just started doing the thing. You put our head down, you go to church. We both had callings. We bought our first house, and we're in this really fantastic little ward where everybody was a reject. You know, you had newlyweds, and then you had people who had built their homes in the 70s that were still living there. Families with 4 kids, families with 10 kids, single moms, single dads. Everybody, you know, never married older ladies, you know, in their 60s and 70s. And it was such a cool space, because when you get into a lot of wards, especially in like Sandy and Draper, and even out here where we live in South Jordan, they're super homogenous. Everybody's the same. Everybody's in the same age range. Everybody has, you know, these kids in the same age range. And if you have a single person, the married family people don't know how to talk to them. I've got a friend who's 34, and she's unmarried, and she can't go to family wards because they don't know what to do with her.
Mm-hmm.
They have no concept of like how to talk to her or how to do anything with her. And so that was a really fantastic place to live, and that's the last place I ever felt like I belonged, at church. Ever since then, we started moving into more affluent areas where everything is the same, and I started hating church more and more. And then I'm kind of a weirdo anyway. Like, it's hard to be fairly liberal in your views when everybody around you is just nodding their head and agreeing, and when people refer to political opinions as, well, we think this in Sunday school. And it's like, well, we don't think anything. You yeah. think that. And we moved around quite a bit. I'm in real estate, and it's kind of a double-edged sword because we've lived in a lot of different houses. We've played Goldilocks. Too big, too small, too far. And finally, we're in a house that we really enjoy. But that was the last place I ever felt like I belonged. And every ward we've ever been in since then, I feel out of place. And I was dealing with that, just feeling out of place. But, you know, no, the church is true. It's the people that are flawed. And, of course, I don't think that anymore. I think that people are true and the church is severely flawed. But my brother, who was, like, hardcore black and white, he and his wife had a long conversation about how awful I was because I turned down a calling to be 11-year-old scoutmaster. And you don't turn down callings. I'm like he was hardcore on Easter. My family was together, and he said, we just want to let everybody know that Danielle and, well, his wife and he were going to take a step back from church.
Wow.
And it was just like, whoa, right? Because he was the hardcore one. Like, he was on track to be bishop kind of guy. You know?
So you never saw it coming?
No, because it was, you were either all in or you all were all out to him. I was never that way. I was a crap Mormon anyway. You know, I was a Sunday Mormon. You give me a Sunday calling, man, I do that all the time. You give me a calling where I have to do something in the week, that's not going to get done. You know, I've probably been home teaching less times than I could count on both hands, you know, in my whole adult life, just because I suck at it. I don't do not Sunday things, but I'm a great teacher. I show up and I'll teach my lesson. I'll always have a lesson ready because that's, you know, that's where I was strong. Anyhow, so my brother left, and he had found a lot of things in church history that had bothered him. And I went to lunch with him and talked to him, and he started sharing with me. He's like, well, I don't want to, that thing where you're like, oh, I don't want to damage your faith. I don't want to tell you about anything you don't know about. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I know about most of the things. And I did. I don't know how, but I knew about the Book of Abraham, and I had shelved it. I knew about, he didn't know about Joseph Smith's polygamy. I knew about that. And it's just like, Brigham Young, you know, polygamy happened at the beginning of the church all the way to this point, and then it didn't anymore. And that was normal to me. I knew about blood atonement and a little bit about Adam God. And these are all things he'd never heard of. He and his wife, his transition was super long. He studied and he built this case and he got ready to tell his wife that he had doubts. And all it took was for her to see that the Helen Mar Kimball story was verified, and she was done. Because the Sunday previously, she'd taught the introductory chapter to the teachings of Joseph Smith, and it hadn't mentioned that he'd married anybody but Emma. And so it's the Wives of Joseph Smith book where the two ladies wrote it.
Mormon Enigma.
Yeah. Anyhow, and so she's like, after reading that and seeing that that was true, she's like, I'm done. She was so angry. She's like, I can't. Why is this something that we don't talk about? I mean, what's the big deal? Everybody knows Brigham Young was a polygamist. Why don't we just, you know, talk about Joseph Smith's polygamy? Well, and of course it's because it was secretive and it was under the table and it was super manipulative in terms of being a very obvious play for power as the leader. So my brother left and we talked and had lunch, and when he asked me about the Book of Abraham, I said, you know, they probably ought to just pull it out of the canon because it causes so many problems. And he says it that way when he's like, oh man, this... He says, I don't, in his mind, he's like, oh, you're not going to last. But I'd learned about Book of Abraham as a teenager. I mean, I'd gone that long. I'd served a mission knowing about it. And I don't know why it didn't bother me.
Let me ask, when you're having this discussion with your brother, were you thinking, oh, you should still go to church? Or were you just accepting him how he was?
I was fine with what he was doing. I was hyper judgmental behind his back. Like, it's that thing where when you go through, you know, when you're processing church, when you're deciding to leave the church or whatever you want to call it, when you're going through a faith crisis, it sucks and it's hard and you're pretty down. And people look at you and they automatically say, oh, he's just sad because he's not going to church anymore. And it's like, no, I'm sad because here's this huge part of my life that essentially just was demolished. Everything that my life was built around. I mean, when you grow up Mormon, your trajectory is set. You know what you're supposed to do. Your whole life is laid out for you, and you know what to do. When that goes away, it's pretty unnerving, you know. And you have kids. You've got to think about how do I bring up my kids? What am I going to teach my kids? If you're in a mixed faith relationship, which my wife and I aren't so mixed faith anymore, but she was still attending when I wasn't after I stopped going. you've got to decide how you're going to approach your kids with the fact that daddy believes this and mommy believes this and grandma believes this. And that's just not, it's so much easier to be like, well, here's the prescribed way to do it. And this is the trajectory that you follow as a Mormon kid. And, you know, you hit these milestones and these goals and the ultimate pinnacle is you get here. And from there, you just keep on, you know, you get married in the temple and that's it. You've arrived. Go have your family and give your life to the church. And when that goes away, you've just kind of got to rethink your whole situation and how you're going to approach life. And what do I believe? What don't I believe? And that's what I went through when my brother left. I'm like, okay, well, I've got to make sure it wasn't like I'm going to double down sort of a thing like a lot of people go through. I wanted to make sure I knew why I was doing everything that I was doing, why I was participating. And while I was going through that is when they announced City Creek. And City Creek broke me. You know, I was able to rationalize Prop 8 to some degree, which really upsets me because that I feel like that should have been enough to see what went on with Prop 8. But when the church announced this bajillion-dollar mall, it broke me. I was just like, that's why I stopped paying tithing. I'm like, I can't give money to this organization. And I hadn't told my wife what I was going through. You know, I was just kind of, I felt like I was all by myself. Like, I'm the crazy person sitting there looking around Sunday school being like, how are you all even processing this? But everyone's just like, yeah. It boggled my brain. And I was playing in a band at the time. I've played in a lot of different bands. I was playing in a band at the time. And after practice, me and the drummer would just end up standing out in the street. And sometimes we'd talk until 2 in the morning. He actually works for the church in a particular capacity. And so we'd talk about these things. And I was really in turmoil. And he's the only person I had talked to about it. I was just like, man, I'm ready to just give up on it all. I don't get it. Nothing makes sense. I'm ready to just throw it all out. And as it happens, the other guy whose house we practiced at was bringing out the garbage, and he heard me say that, and he walked over, and he's like, well, hold on. Let me send you some stuff and see if it helps. And he linked me over to a bunch of Mormon Stories podcasts, the Stages of Faith one, and I was listening to that, and I was like, wow, they're just talking about me, you know? And honestly, that probably kept me in the church for another 6 or 8 months. But the problem was I was listening to these podcasts. I started listening to anything I could find. So all of the podcasts that were around at the time that were, like, Mormon Expression was too harsh at that point still. And a lot of people will say there's a trajectory. You go from this one to this one. And when you arrive at Mormon Expression, you finally know that you're okay with, you know, really talking about difficult issues in a critical way, not in a way it's like, let's try to make it work. It's like, and when you can listen to John just spout off John's stuff, that, you know, you're all right with it. But I was listening to so many podcasts, and I always had an earbud in my ear that I felt like I had to explain to my wife what was going on. So I did the thing that you're not supposed to do. I took her to dinner.
Oops.
At our favorite restaurant, which is still our favorite restaurant.
Oh, I was going to ask if you ever went back again.
I took her to dinner, and we sat down. And it's a really, really nice place. And so we're just eating, and I told her that I needed to talk to her about some things. And you get really nervous because, like, I know people whose marriages break up over this stuff. Like, personally, like, somebody has issues with the church, and the spouse is like, well, now we're not on the same page. I'm gone. And I wanted to give my wife the benefit of the doubt, but you just don't know because she was a very, very, you know, all-in believer. And so I just told her, I said, look, I'm not sure the church is what it claims to be. I'm having trouble reconciling a few things. And we had this conversation, and she was really cool about it, but she's a processor. So she takes a long time to respond to things. I just word vomit. You know, my brain goes, and I just talk. But she processes, and so we had this conversation, and I just kind of spit everything out on her, and she was really cool and calm about it, and we finished dinner, and we drove home, and if I recall, we were getting ready for bed, and she asked me, she said, okay, well, with all of this, you're still you, right? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, that doesn't change. And she says, well, then we're going to be fine. And that was kind of the end of the stress in it. She was like, as long as who I was, the type of husband I was, the type of father I was, didn't change, as long as I was still present, as long as I was still involved, as long as all the things that I do that make her want to stay married to me didn't change, then she didn't really think it was a big deal if I didn't believe in the church. And when my family found out, my sister got all upset and called my wife, and my wife says to her, "Do you really think that God would keep Keith out of heaven because he doesn't believe in Joseph Smith?" And my sister kind of was taken aback by that, and she's like, "Well, no." And she's like, "Well, neither do I, so what's the big deal?" And so she just took everything in stride, and it was so cool, and I just feel like I hit the lottery in that regard, because once she had wrapped her brain around that, she was open to talking to me, and she started being open to listening to some podcasts. And she still believed, and we discussed the things I was going through, and everything I had a problem with was modern church. Everything. You know, I didn't really care about the history. I mean, history screwed up, and I got more interested in it later on, but I had a problem with the way that the Big 15 were running the modern church, building malls and owning a ton of Florida, and like having this church that's not a church, this is a business, but I should trust what you're doing, because, you know, I was the type that thought that every Thursday they'd go into the temple and, you know, Jesus would descend out and sit at the head of the table and be like, "All right, gentlemen, this is what's on the docket for today. This is what we're going to talk about. These are the important issues." And when you realize that even they admit that that's not the way it is, even though they don't come out and say it, when you look at how Spencer Kimball finally got to the point where the church would allow, you know, black folks to go to the temple and get the priesthood and such, it's just like anybody else. I prayed about it. I felt good. So I came to you and said, "Hey, I prayed about it and I felt good. Will you guys pray about it and feel good?" And then I found out that they had their unanimous vote when one of the 12 was gone on an assignment and he was the holdout. And so they were able to have unanimity because he was gone. And I mean, you know, but it was just like, this isn't the church that I thought it was. And I was having a really hard time. So I just kind of, I ditched Mormonism. And I started looking at the Bible and particularly the New Testament. The problem is, when you really look at the New Testament critically and the Bible critically, it's just as big a mess as Mormonism is, if not bigger. And so I started reading Ehrman and learning about textual criticism and authorship attribution and pseudepigrapha. And for me, and I'd say this, and I'm pretty soft about it, but for me, a lot of people have seen the same information I've seen and come to a different conclusion, and that's fine. But to me, the conclusion I came to was that the man Jesus of Nazareth, if he existed, never started a church. He was a leader of a reform movement trying to get Judaism back on track. But he didn't organize a church. He didn't call the 12 apostles, a first presidency and 12 apostles. He didn't organize a structure. He was a millennialist prophet trying to reform the Jewish religion. When I came to the conclusion that the man Jesus had never started a church, then there's nothing to restore. And the entire Mormon situation just is done. You know, it doesn't matter what happened in the history, because if there was no Christian church to restore, if there was no restoration necessary because there was nothing to restore, then it didn't matter. And that's about when I was done. And I continued to attend for my wife, because sending your wife to church, we had three kids at the time. With three kids, it's just mean.
And how old were your children at the time?
I was going through that. My oldest, I believe, was a little over six, which would have made, it would have been six. Sorry, I've got to do the math. Six, three, and a baby. I mean, the baby's three now.
Yeah, that would be baby. A little mean.
You know, yeah, it's like, well, and besides the fact that, like, when you have kids that little, sacrament meeting is worthless. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't matter who you are. You know, I don't know how anybody gets anything out of sacrament meeting anyway, but when you have little kids, there's no chance, you know. And the funny thing was, after I talked to my wife, she's like, "Oh, everything makes sense now," because I'd be super willing to take the kids out in the hall, and then we'd go to class, and I was attending the Church of Angry Birds. I would just have my tablet, and I would just be playing games on my tablet because I didn't want to engage, because it wasn't doing anything for me. So after that, I mean, you get into looking at the Bible. It's really hard to hang on to, from in my experience, it's hard to hang on to any Christian faith at that point. You know, when you really look at how the Bible came to be, and, you know, how the books of Moses came to be, when you look at the best theories in terms of sources and how they came together, when you look at all the mythologies that spring up out of the Bible and you can tie them to other mythologies, you know, like Mithras and the Epic of Gilgamesh and all of these things, you know, Christianity fell apart for me. And then at the end of the day, the whole idea that of the loving parent figure kind of dissipates for me. And you know, so what I tell people is I'm an agnostic atheist, which is just to say that I don't know. If somebody were to ask me, you know, does God exist? I don't know. If they'd ask me if I believe in God, the answer would be no. And I lived my life from that space. And it's been a better space for me. But so my three oldest sisters are all still very active in the church. And none of my brothers are. And you know, the three of them responded very differently. My oldest sister was very upset. She's probably the most strong in terms of what it looks like to be a good Mormon. Her husband was the bishop for 7 years. They stayed in a neighborhood because they felt they were needed as a positive influence, even though it was a crap neighborhood. Like, they really, it's what works in their life. And she called me. She was very distraught, very upset, very concerned that I was reading anti-Mormon stuff. And she made me promise to read the Book of Mormon just as much as I read anything that was anti-Mormon. And the thing was, everything I was reading wasn't anti-anything. It was just research materials. I mean, when you're reading Ehrman, it's not like he's anti something. He's saying this is what it looks like, and this is the conclusions that I came to, and this is why, and this is what this, you know. But he doesn't conclude, therefore, you shouldn't believe in any of this. He's just pointing out that based on the extant records that we have, this is how it happened, you know. And my sister was very upset, and I said, sure, I will, because I wasn't reading anything anti-Mormon. I hadn't even read any of the books that a lot of people get into. I hadn't read, what is it? I haven't read any Quinn's books. I still haven't, but Grant Palmer's book,
Insider's View
of Mormon Origins. I hadn't read that. I hadn't read Rough Stone Rolling or No Man Knows My History. I hadn't read any of that sort of stuff. You know, everything I've ever seen that's anti-Mormon, like that I would label anti-Mormon, is ridiculous. Like, it's the really silly stuff that just like reaches way out there, the God makers, that sort of thing. It's like, Mormonism's weird enough. You don't have to embellish, you know, but a lot of these things, it's like, and then we do this and this. And it's like, yeah, the problem is you're adding like 10% of not quite true to it. And that allows people to dismiss it. And it's weird enough on its own. The idea of Kolob is weird enough on its own. You know, you don't have to bring in the having endless celestial sex with his many wives. It's like, well, that's just hyperbole for people who are in the church. They don't see it that way, you know. But the idea that the cosmology that Joseph Smith came up with is just so ridiculous, is ridiculous enough on its own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the difference between thinking that only our solar system exists, and then it's like, okay, well, only our galaxy exists. And then we start to see that our galaxy is one of billions of galaxies in the observable universe, and that's just in the observable universe. You know, the small thinking that it exists inside of the cosmology that comes out in the Book of Abraham and that, it just doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous enough on its own, I guess, was my point. That's a long way to say it.
Yeah.
My middle sister is the middle sister of my oldest sister's. She's so cool. And I went to lunch with her, and she wanted to know what was going on. And she said, well, look, I understand you're going through this. I understand it's hard. She says, it works for me. She said, I love you no matter what. And then she said, what I need to know from you is, what can I talk to you about? You know, if I'm going to talk about church stuff and my kids, what they're doing in church and our callings, is that going to upset you? And I said, of course it's not. I mean, that's a part of her life. And
I love that viewpoint of her to ask you and to be concerned about you.
Uh-huh.
That's wonderful.
And then the youngest of my sisters is a drama queen. So she called me up and she was just crying, you know, oh, I'm so concerned, you know, the no empty chairs in the celestial kingdom and all of this stuff. The problem was she was walking her new dog at the time she was talking to me. So she'd be like, and I'm just so concerned about him. And then she would just stop and go, no, he's a Weimaraner. Yeah, he's just a puppy. Yeah. Okay, see ya. You know, and it was just like, why are you even talking to me? You, how much do you really care? You know, it's like you're walking your dog and you're able to shift out of, you know, concern for my immortal soul to explaining that your dog's just a puppy. That doesn't make any, you know, so it's just like crazy. And I went and talked to my brother and he's like, oh, good. And that was it, you know. he brews his own beer. He's like, you got to try my beer. I'm like, I don't like beer. He's like, yeah, you'll like my beer. I'm like, whatever, you know. And on we go. But that my family was really cool. My oldest brother lived out of state at the time, and he and I don't, like, we talk once or twice a year. And we'll talk for a long time when we talk, but we don't have, like, a super communicative relationship.
Was that normal, or was that after you left?
That's normal. He's the one that got sent home from his mission. Okay. And, you know, that's just how our relationship was. Our relationship was a lot closer. When he got sent home, my hero worship of him really dissipated, and he noticed it. We've talked about it since. And he said it was really hard for him to be around me because I didn't look at him the same way. Because I kind of worshipped him. I thought he was, like, the coolest guy. And then he got sent home, and it's like, oh, maybe you're not. And it's such a douchey thing to do, but...
It's kind of what you're raised to do.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you're told what's right and wrong, but you're not supposed to judge. It's you can't really play around with it.
No. And my younger brother, he had already passed away at this time, too, so there was not an encounter there. So by the time I'd left, both of my parents and my younger brother had died.
Okay. And I did want to talk about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. Are you comfortable
talking
about them?
I'm a little flip about it because I've told the story so many times. So I hope that, like, the people who are listening don't think that, like, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
It's just my brother died in 1998.
How old were you?
I was 18 and he was 17.
Okay.
And that was my first experience with losing somebody close to me. Like, my grandpa had died at that point, and I'd had a great aunt that had died and that sort of thing. I had a friend in school that died, and then a friend whose sister died, but nobody, like, close to me. And the funny thing is, I remember my friend's little sister died in a car accident the year before my brother died, and I remember thinking, wow, I don't even know what that would be like, because my brother and I were, his name was Mark, we were only 14 months apart, and my friend and her sister were about the same amount apart, and I just couldn't wrap my brain around what it would be like to have that happen. And a year later, I was just standing right there in the same space. So I was getting ready to go do the mission thing, and I had gone to get my wisdom teeth out. And this is it's March 6th, this day. And I went to work, and then I went to the dentist, and my parents met me at the dentist, and I got my wisdom teeth out, and we drove home, and it was just snowing like crazy, as it only can in Utah. It's like, it'll be really warm, and then it'll drop a foot and a half of snow in the middle of March, at the beginning of March. It's just like, so it was just snowing insane that day. And we drove home, and I was with my dad, and my mom had taken my car. My dad and I pulled up in the driveway and opened the garage, and my little brother was, he was working on my mom's car. He was really mechanically minded. He'd replaced engines and transmissions at 17. Like, he was basically on the track to, you know, doing that type of work, being really good at a vocational skill. The kid was really smart. And so it looked like he was just working on the car. And we got out of the car, and so he was underneath, and his legs were just sticking out the bottom, just totally normal. And we tried to talk to him, and he didn't respond. He didn't say anything, you know. And usually he would come up with some really smart-ass response to whatever you said, because he was a smart-ass. And so I kicked his foot to get his attention, and his foot was pointing up, and his foot just dropped to the side, you know. And, like, your stomach just lurches, you know. And so I run around to the side of the car, and he had been under the car and had one tire off, and he had the car up on a jack, but he hadn't put the secondary jack stand in, and somehow the car had slipped off the jack, and it was a 1984 Nissan 300ZX, so it's a really low slung car. And so the car had fallen, and the axle had hit him across the chest, and it was low enough that essentially what they told us is that it would have knocked the wind out of him, and he would have gone unconscious almost immediately, and then he likely suffocated. And so I looked under the car, and there was my brother, and he was laying there, and it didn't look stressful or painful. He really looked pretty peaceful. So I believe whatever the doctors told me, and that makes it easier for me. And so my most vivid memory of that is, and the funny thing is, I can't remember which side of the car I was on, because in my memory, when I was walking up to the car was on one side of the garage. It was a two-car garage. But in my memory of using the jack to lift the car off of my brother, I was on the other side of the garage. And I remember I was wearing a yellow ski parka, and my back was to the heater that he had on while he was working. And I remember I had to spin the jack back down so I could get it under the car to lift the car off of him. And my back was so hot because I was, like, right next to the heater, And I remember thinking, you know, like, your brain's just racing. And I remember thinking, oh, my coat's going to melt. But I just kept, you know, and so I lifted the car off of Mark, and my dad pulled him out, and we started doing CPR. But at that point, he'd been, we don't know when it happened, but it was long enough that there was, we didn't know at the time, but, you know, there was no reviving him, obviously. We're talking about when my brother died. And so they couldn't send the life flight chopper because of the snow, so the fire truck came that has the ambulance on board, and they grabbed and put him on the fire truck and headed up to university and trying to revive him along the way. And my mom and I got in the back of a police car with a detective, and we're driving up to the hospital. I'm holding my mom's hand saying, my dad went with my brother in the ambulance, I'm holding my mom's hand saying, it's going to be okay, you raise survivors, you know, Mark will be all right, you know, it's okay. And we get up to, it was all the way up at university hospital, and we get up there, and my mom and I are walking up to the doors, and the sliding doors slide open, and the first thing I hear is my older sister screaming, I want my brother back. And that's how I found out my brother died. This is the same drama queen sister who was walking her dog and crying on the phone. But that's not how I wanted to find out that he didn't make it, and it's definitely not how I wanted my mom to find out that he didn't make it. And so that, you grow up really fast when that happens. You know, he and I started our first band together. I still play in a band with the two guys we started that band with, and they're my two very best friends, because one of them was my best friend and the other one was his best friend. And we all just kind of gravitated to each other when Mark died, because what else do you have left, you know? But as a believing person who's going on a mission, like, my first thought is, okay, I asked my mom, I said, let me be his proxy at the temple. And she said, of course. And so that's where my brain went at first. Mm-hmm. And as a believer, that's what you do. You kind of defer any of it to, it's going to be okay.
That's also a comfort for people. And that's one thing I don't want to take from Mormons, is that comfort.
No, it's just hard when that goes away for you, you know. And it's almost, there's a dark side to it. I don't want to say a dark side, but that's what I'm going to say. And that's that. If you get sad, somehow it means that you don't believe enough or that you don't have enough faith. And I experienced that. Like, my brother died on a Friday. My older brother got married the next day. And then the rest of us, like, you know, my parents and me and one of my older brothers and one of my older sisters, we all went to church on Sunday. You know, we wandered into sacrament meeting 2 minutes late, and there was only a bench in the front, so we look like the big, strong Mormon family coming to church right after a tragedy. And looking back, it was just like, why? You know, that has got to be a good enough reason to skip sacrament meeting. But that's not the way we did it. My dad, growing up, brought us up to, and this is my experience, my siblings have had different experiences. And the funny thing is, you think as a parent, you raise all your kids the same, but all your kids experience you differently. And to me, my dad wanted to show us what a real Mormon looks like. You know, a real Mormon man wears a white shirt when he's doing the priesthood. A real Mormon man does this. A real Mormon man does that. And so we looked like the real Mormon family. You know, there's no dark, insidious stuff that was going on behind the scenes. We were a decent Mormon family. We didn't do family home evening regularly because it always devolved into family home argument. But we showed up to church and we looked the part. And in the months after Mark died, probably every 3 weeks or so, I would just break down, like, in really weird, bizarre ways. You know, I'd curl up in a ball and just start crying. And about 2 months after, 3 months after, now 2 months after he died, my girlfriend's like, hasn't it been long enough? And I'm like,
ouch.
Right? And I'm like, wow, I can't believe you said that to me, you know. And he died in March of 98, and I left. I entered the MTC for the first time in June of 98. And then I went back out and went on my mission in November. So that all happened that year. But it's interesting that, you know, you go through that and you have to grow up a lot. And so, of course, when I got on my mission, missionaries are a bunch of idiots. And I felt like I didn't know what most of them were doing there. It didn't make any sense to me that you would go and participate in this the way that you're doing it. And I was a hardcore rules guy. After I got home, I met my wife, and we got engaged, and it would have been December of 2001, my mom was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And that was a real treat, you know. It was all on top of, I'm getting married, so I'm super self-absorbed at the time, and my mom's going through this, and she started doing chemotherapy, and she'd get better and get worse. And anybody who's had a loved one go through an intense cancer knows that your whole life gets put on hold, and then when your loved one starts to get better, you feel like you can live life again. And then when they regress, everything gets put on hold again. And so my mom was going through these cycles for about 5 years. And she was doing pretty good. Had my first son in July of 2005. And in October of 2005, I'm asleep, and I'd taken to turning my phone off at night. I just had a cell phone at the time. And I'd taken to turning it off at night because I'd get calls in the middle of the night, and it was just annoying. There's a knock on my door. You know, so I go down and I look out, and my older brother's standing in there, and he says, "Dad's been in a car accident. We need to get up to the hospital, you know, and give him a blessing." My dad was blind in one eye and had very little peripheral vision in the other eye. There was no excuse for him driving, but he always had a license somehow. And he used to say, people would ask him, "How do you drive?" He'd say, "Well, I turn my head and I crash into people a lot." And he'd been in several car accidents, and we drove up, and so, like, we know the drill. You go up, you give Dad a blessing. He has to recuperate for a while. He was a big man. He weighed north of 280 pounds. He was 6 feet tall. And again, we get to the hospital up there, and I walk in, and the neurologist is talking to my mom, and all I hear is, "There's no brain activity." And then I'm like, oh, shit, again, right? I get to walk through the door of a hospital and hear somebody say something that lets me know that somebody that I love is going to be leaving my life again. And it was hard. My wife was at home with the baby. We were just waiting for the rest of my siblings to get there. My dad was on life support, and we all were in the room, and they took him off life support, and there we were. But people will talk about this moment where somebody dies and everything feels different, but it felt exactly the same, you know. And of course you rationalize that and say, well, he was dead before we got there. He was being kept alive by machines. So when you believe in a dualist world, it's like, well, his spirit had already left. Everything's cool, right? And so we go through that, and that's in October of 2005. And at this point, my family again goes through the same thing we did with Mark. We do the funeral, we show up, everybody's strong, my family grows together, and we're still really close as a result. And my brother moves in with my mom to make sure somebody's there he and his wife and their kids move in with my mom, and they're helping take care of her, and we move forward. And then in December, my mom went in for treatment, and this nurse told one of my siblings, or told my mom, that it didn't look like she'd have a lot of time left. It didn't look like they were going to be able to get a handle on the cancer. Well, my mom appeared to look fine. Appeared to everybody that she just looked fine. So my family got super mad at this nurse. It's like, how dare you take this away from us? She's doing well, you know. Like, we all got really angry, because it's just like, you don't get to tell us. You're just a nurse, right? It's ridiculous to, you know, think about it now. And she needed to go in for a surgery in January, and they were going to remove some more of the cancer because they could see that it was still there. When they opened her up in January, they basically opened her up and just closed her back up and said, it's everywhere. We can't do anything. You know, there's no way to take it out. And it was the tumors had grown and had basically closed off her digestive tract, so she couldn't eat. And so they said, this was middle of January-ish, if I'm remembering right. If any of my siblings listen to this, they might be able to correct me. Your life gets put on hold. Nothing happens after that. So she got put on home hospice care. We all took shifts coming to sit and be with her. And they gave her like a week. And she lasted like 5 or 6. And so for 5 or 6 weeks, and I'm sure a lot of people have had this experience, your life has stopped. Nothing else is happening in your life. You still have to go to work. You still have to do the things that you're doing. But nothing's happening. You know, when you lose a loved one, that's what happens. You drive around and you see everybody else driving around, and you're like, there's that part of you that's like, how dare you? How dare you continue to have this experience? How dare you just keep going on with your life? Don't you know that everything about my life has just been upended? And So then my mom died in February of 2006. And it sucks, you know, but you do the thing, and that's that thing, the comforting thing. You grab onto your beliefs and you say, this is okay, everything's okay. And that works as long as you have those beliefs. And for me, the problem was when I stopped having those beliefs, what do I do? You know, you've got to look back at everything that's happening. You've got to process it all over again. And so if you look at like the Kubler-Ross model of stages of grief, when you're a believer, you get to skip some of those stages in your mind. You feel like you just get to leapfrog over to acceptance because death isn't a final thing. It's a deferment. When you don't believe that anymore, you've got to go back to the beginning. And so you go through the denial and the anger and the bargaining and all of that. And you've got to process it all over again. And it sucks. Earlier this week, my kids wanted to see what I looked like when I was their age. And my mom had put together a baby book that she gave me when I was 8 and had pictures of me. And they wanted to see if I looked like any of their siblings and, you know, what my hair looked like, all this stuff. And so we were looking through my baby book, and I told them that my mom had given it to me. And we talk about my mom and dad a lot. We talk about my brother Mark. And my wife mentioned to Noah that when my mom was sick, she had written him a letter. And Noah wanted to see the letter. And so my wife got out the letter and started reading it to the kids. And it was hard. It was a super painful thing, because I hadn't read it in a long time. And I hadn't read it from the space where I'm at. And my mom had written these really, like, interesting things where she's like, you know, she says, dearest baby Noah. And then she said, let me start over. This is so my mom. She's like, in this letter, she's like, dearest baby Noah, wait, let me start over, because by the time you get this, you probably won't be a baby anymore. And then she's like, well, I'm your grandma Anne, and I'm really sorry that I won't be there to put Band-Aids on your owies and to fill up squirt guns for you, and like these things that I wouldn't have thought of. And it's different now, because I've had to spend the last, you know, 2 or 3 years re-mourning the loss of the people that I love and coming to grips with the potential that I might not see them again. I have hope for it. I would love for that to be the case, because I miss my parents. You know, I miss my little brother. But you process it differently. And that hope that you had, that you don't have it anymore. It's a different situation. It's one of those things where, like, when I was a believer, I'd go to funerals for people who weren't, and I would see how sad their families were, and I was like, oh, it's so sad, they just don't have the truth. But in reality, the family was just going through what you normally go through. And having to do that 5 years after your parents died, or a decade after your brother died, is strange. I was talking to a friend of mine who lost her mom a couple years ago, and she's reframing what she believes. And she says, what do you do? She says, how do you... Sorry, my kid's crying in the background.
That's all right.
What do you do? She asked me. And I said, you kind of have to go back to zero. You've got to grieve and mourn them all over again. Because if you think there could be a chance that you're not going to see them again, if there's a chance that at the end of life it's just lights out, you've got to go back, and you've got to process that. And it hadn't occurred to her that that's what you'd have to do, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to be like, oh, well, I've been fine for 10 years and now I've got to go back and feel shitty about this again. And it's not like you have to, but you need to process it through your new worldview. I mean, that happens with everybody who leaves the church. You you've got to process your entire world differently. And when you've experienced loss, it changes. You want to hold on to those things because on some level it's easier. It's easier to defer your sadness in favor of an eternity. When you come to the conclusion that the likelihood of there being an eternity for you is pretty low, you can still hope for that, but you've got to come to grips with the potential reality of the situation. And I probably should have seen a counselor. I've never seen a counselor. My wife and I talk a lot, and that's how we process a lot of things, but it's, I don't know, in terms of when people are going through that, really, you almost, in my opinion, you have to go back and you've got to re-experience the loss through your new worldview. And that's, it's not something people want to do. It's not something I wanted to do. And it doesn't get better. And maybe that's probably the most important thing. We've had friends who experienced loss. My wife's best friend had a rare brain tumor, and she died when she was 29 years old. About 2 years later, her husband successfully completed a suicide attempt. And like, we've had this stuff happen. And people, when people lose somebody, they ask me, "Well, what do you do?" And I said, "It doesn't get easier." You know, that hole that's left in your life when the person is gone, nothing fills it. It doesn't get any easier. You just get used to it. You know, and I wrote a song to that end, to give to this husband of my wife's best friend, because he said that gave him more comfort than anything anybody else was saying, because he wasn't really a believer. He was a semi-closeted gay man. You know, like, his whole situation wasn't in line with the church or what have you. And he said that was the best thing anybody said to him. And when he told me that, that's just what I deferred to. When somebody loses somebody, I don't flower it up. I don't sugarcoat it. I say, look, it sucks. And a lot of people, they want to hear that. Like, every time I talk to somebody, they're like, thanks for saying it's okay to be upset. Because they hear all the time, oh, it must be God's plan, or oh, it's okay, or another angel, or whatever the stuff that you say that can be comforting. But nobody ever gets the other side of it. Nobody ever talks to you about the long-term impact of it. You know, that a year later, you still don't feel normal when you lose somebody. When I say you don't feel normal again, it's just that the way you feel becomes the new normal. The way that you have to look at the world, it all becomes new. You've got to live in a world, I have to live in a world where I get to wonder what my little brother would be like if he were gonna, you know, if he were in his 30s and had kids. I get to wonder what my kids' relationship with my parents would be like, because they only ever met my oldest, and he's 8 now. Everything changes. And I really, my wife still, she'd say she's agnostic about everything, but she really likes certain things, so she chooses to believe those things because they bring her comfort, and I'm totally cool with that. I have a hard time choosing to believe. That's just not how my brain works. It's not how I process things. But it's just that thing. Your whole world shifts and changes, and it doesn't get any easier, and it doesn't get better, and you don't suddenly have the ability to return to your previous life. You just get used to what your life is now. And you can have happiness in that life. And that's probably the most messed up thing. It's like, when you lose somebody and you start to feel happy again, you get guilt about it. You know, even if it's a couple months after you lose somebody and you find yourself happy and smiling, you feel like you're doing a disservice to the deceased person, because you shouldn't be happy. It's losing people screws you up so much. And it's like, I should see a counselor. I just am too lazy. My wife's family there are 3 family therapists in her immediate family. Her dad's a therapist, her brother's a therapist, her sister's a therapist. This is what her family does. I wouldn't go see them, of course, but I recognize the need for therapy and for people to see a counselor. And that's something that I continually see being less and less stigmatized, and I appreciate that. you know, I know that I should see a counselor. And it's not that I think there's anything wrong with seeing a counselor. I'm honestly just too lazy or too cheap to do it. And, you know, I'm self-employed, so I don't have, like, insurance that'll pay for it. I am self-insured, and it covers crap right now till I have to start paying more for my insurance at the end of the year when my plan phases out of the stuff. But anyhow, I don't know. What else do you want to know?
No, I can relate to a lot what you're saying, and what I'm finding talking to ex-Mormons is that they feel grief a lot more than Mormons, and they also feel happiness a lot more. I think as Mormons, you're taught to do service, so in the afterlife you'll get blessings, and oh, you can't feel sorry about this because you'll see your loved one again. And so your feelings are pretty much leveled out.
Yep.
You don't have these extreme highs and lows that I think people that don't have that faith basis have.
I would absolutely agree with that. It's just weird to look at it in that way. When you talk about balance. Balance isn't feeling the same all the time. Balance is... making, like, if you talk about balance and that, your highs and lows kind of are going to balance each other out, but that doesn't mean that you have this level thing. And I think in Mormonism, I don't think it's explicitly taught. I don't think a lot of things that we learn as Mormons are explicitly taught. Some things are, but like the idea that, you know, you always must be happy and you always must be, you know, this idea of being anxiously engaged in a good cause and like all the little, you know, buzz phrases and cliches that only make sense to Mormons. They teach us in terms of this is how it looks and we got to look this way. And that's why so often you have, you know, you have these families where everything looks fine because you've got to have this sheen, this image of we're doing everything and this is what it looks like. When in reality, no family's that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every family is as regular and screwed up as every other family. And the ability to embrace that, it's important, because when you can embrace your own screwed upness, I make up words, you can be okay with other people's stuff. You know, nobody is the same, and nobody's path is the same. Nobody walks the same road as you do. And the disservice I think that any organized religion does is says this is the road you must walk. This is the one and only path. This is the way to get it done. You know, and of course we certainly teach that in the Mormon church. Like, this is it, you know, the straight and narrow path. And it's just like there's no one size fits all approach to life. There's just not. You know, I know that we want there to be one. I know that everybody wants the magic bullet that will fix everything. But human beings as a species, the way we evolved, there's so much difference between us that there's not a magic bullet. There's not a one size fits all approach to life. What I do and what works for me, this idea of being happier, honestly, in a space of non-belief versus people who feel they're happier in a space of belief. I don't want to take that away from anybody. You know, if the church works for somebody, fine, you know. And I find that the more I'm that way, the more they're cool with the way I approach life. The more they're okay with what I'm doing and how I'm approaching it. My father-in-law was a CES director and an institute teacher and like all this stuff. He has been so cool about everything. But he's super New Order Mormon. He's like way out there. Like,
really?
Yeah, he goes to a Mormon church that I don't think exists.
Really?
He's crafted his own Mormonism, but it's beautiful. If his Mormonism was Mormonism, if getting on to that, if we had that,
if we could all make our own Mormonism,
yeah,
it would be better for everyone.
Once I tell people, I say correlation took away everything that was great about the early church. Because the early church was about debate and about speculative theology. And even though I don't believe, I love talking about speculative theology. I think it's fascinating to look at the world through those eyes and discuss that with people, you know, who want to talk about it in as real ways as they can get. But my father-in-law and my mother-in-law have been fantastic. My wife and I both did, this was several years ago, we both did really big, long interviews for a project that John DeLynn was doing. where they just wanted to, I think they've since abandoned it, but they wanted to basically put together a library of LDS experience for people who are doing research projects to have access to. So we both did multi-hour interviews that just ended up here. Well, my in-laws listened to those twice. It was like, mine was 3 hours, my wife's was 3.5 hours. They listened to both of the interviews twice. They listened to a few podcasts that we said would help them understand where we were coming from. And my mother-in-law said to my wife once, she said, you know, I don't think anybody has the right to... I was the one who was more open about where I was coming from. She says, I don't think anybody has the right to talk to Keith about what he's going through unless they're willing to listen to these. Because it goes back to that journey thing. Nobody's journey is the same. My journey coming up in Mormonism was different than my siblings. And it colored and impacted the way that I look at the world and the way that I processed, my own apostasy or my own leaving the faith. And without that background, we don't know that. And then you go back to correlation, where it's like we have to find these four things that explain it. And the last time my wife went to church, they taught a lesson on why people leave. And it was all the same hackneyed, cliched responses. They were offended. They wanted to sin. And she was boiling almost to a point where she was going to say something. And then the baby started crying, and she had to go feed the baby. At this point, she had skipped sacrament meeting and was going to church on her own because it wasn't healthy for me to be there anymore. And she was just kind of done after that. Because when you say you build your own Mormonism, we don't talk about different things. And the Mormon church now is about trying to not even define capital T truth. It's about trying to tell you this is capital T truth regardless of what reality looks like around you. This is capital T truth. And we believe this truth no matter what the evidence says to the contrary. And I would prefer, I don't like Brigham Young. I think he's a complete tool. But when you go back to the debates between Brigham Young and Orson Pratt, and that these are guys who are leaders of the church getting angry at each other about the way the other one looks at the nature of God. You know, that's kind of cool. I mean, I don't want to listen to the 4-hour sermons, but what if we had more of that? You know, as you say, general conference is going on right now. It's the same talks that have been given for the last 20 years. You know, at that point where they're proving their point by quoting themselves in a talk they gave 10 years ago. Doesn't make sense.
I'm reading a journal by Abraham Cannon, an apostle, in like 1831 something. Mm-hmm. And they talk about how when they sustain people, they're actually voting for people, and they would vote people out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not how it's done anymore.
Now, the early church is such a colorful, interesting thing. I don't believe in anything supernatural at this juncture, but that would be a church I could get on board with. I mean, it's an exciting church that... In Brazil, there are a lot of churches. It was in northern Brazil. And the churches are in almost like strip malls, is what you would describe it as. Except for it's not like one glass door that opens up like you see in a strip mall now. It's really hot, and so like the whole front of the church is just like overhead garage doors. And when they have their services, they open up all of them. So you'll have like 5 garage doors open into this church. And people are speaking in tongues and casting out demons. And as a missionary, you're like, well, that's just silly. Truth be told, that's your church in its early days. You know, that's what they were doing. It was a Pentecostal-style church with gifts of the Spirit. And, you know, church is boring today. We had the bishop in the neighborhood came over, you know, for a drop-by, which is just ridiculous. But, like, I told him, I said, look, even if I did believe, church is boring. You have to admit that church meetings are super boring. You know,
Did he admit it?
He just laughed, which means yes, he agreed, but he didn't want to say yes, they are. I love to sing. I've been singing in bands for a long time. I always loved being...
Oh, I thought you said you love to sin.
Well, I do love to sin, but... I love being in ward choir because I'm a dick, and I'm a really good singer, and it's really easy to be the best singer in a ward choir. And so then there's like this need for you, and you feel needed. And that's one of those things where it's just like, I couldn't even go back to sing, because singing in ward choir is one thing if you've got a good director who's picking cool songs. Like, religious music can be really cool. The hymn book sucks. There are maybe 5 or 6 hymns that I can still really, like,
They're probably not LDS hymns.
No, well, most of the hymns aren't LDS hymns. You go through them and you think we have this magic book full of Mormon hymns, and it's like, now we got a couple. We got Praise to the Man, which, you know, sorry, I just gave a stupid double thumbs up. You know, we have Oh My Father. We have, you know, we have these Come Come Ye Saints. We have all these super Mormon-centric hymns. But the ones that I find most beautiful from a music standpoint, Be Still My Soul. That's an awesome song. I Stand All Amazed was my mom's favorite hymn. When she was dying, I played and sang that to her several times. And, you know, there's some beautiful religious music.
I still love How Great Thou Art.
How Great Thou Art.
My favorite.
It's one of those things, like, when you realize that that's not a Mormon song. No. Like, I was taking piano lessons as a kid, and I had that as a song, but it was like, it was the sheet music, and on the cover of the sheet music, there was like this cross, and, you know, and I'm like, why is there a cross on my Mormon music? But you don't realize, I mean, growing up in the church, especially in Utah, everything is the church. You don't have any other options. It's like, this is what it is. This is reality, and your whole reality revolves around that. You know, I've heard stories of some of my nieces and nephews when they've heard, like, I know this church is true. They'll go to another ward, and they'll be like, oh, this church can't be true. Our church is true over there at our ward. And their parents have to be like, oh, no, we're all the same. And it's just like, I don't know. Mormonism is weird.
I wish you could see him. He has his head in his hands.
Well, it's just like, it's the most normal thing in the world when that's all you know. Mm-hmm. And until you step outside of it, you don't realize how weird and interesting it is. You really don't. People say that old trope about you can leave the church, but you can't leave it alone. It's like, well, A, I don't want to, because I don't want to say that. I don't want to say you people are interesting, but the Mormon beliefs are interesting. You know, they're kind of out there, and like the spectrum of belief in terms of your super fundamentalist people versus your Jack Mormons. Man, Jack Mormons don't make any sense to me. You know, if you believe it, do it. I mean, I can't even imagine living a life where it's like, I believe this is true, but I'm not going to do any of it. It's got to be like the most conflicted life ever. But, and then as you get into like all the different branches of the Joseph Smith movement, you know, when I talk to people, I say, I talk about, oh, you know, in the Brighamite church, I'm like, it's not really the Brighamite church. We're like the Church of Heber J. Grant. You know, the Brighamite church is closer to the FLDS church and Warren Jeffs and that. I mean, that's much closer to what the Brighamite church was. Say nothing of, like, the Strangites and, you know, like, all of the branches that have, you know, the Temple Lot church, all these little ones. Like, well, we're the biggest one, so we must be the right one. It's like, well, if you really go back to Joseph Smith and you're talking about lines of authority, everything is screwed up when he dies. Because he didn't leave a clear plan, because I honestly think that he thought Second Coming was coming. I think Joseph Smith was a millennialist prophet who was convinced Jesus was on his way. Just like every millennialist prophet has been convinced that Jesus is on his way since Jesus himself thought Jesus was coming back. You know? We're still waiting. You know? But millennialist churches, as they grow, like, you can look at religious trajectories of churches that develop over time, and especially millennialist churches. They all follow the same trajectory. The early Christian church followed the trajectory that the early Mormon church followed, and the Seventh-day Adventist church followed that same thing. And it's like, you go from being a very exciting and dynamic millennialist, the end is nigh sort of church, to after a certain amount of time, you just calm it down, and you're like, we're just a church now, and you got to stay a church because you're an organization. You've got to keep the organization going, you know? When you look at the parallels anytime a religion starts with a charismatic leader and with the death of the charismatic leader, if there's somebody who's built to basically pick up the church and run with it, it'll survive. If there's not, it won't. We had that, and I don't think it's Peter. I think when when Jesus of Nazareth died, Peter and James, the brother of Jesus, were trying to do their thing, and then Paul came along, and Paul upended the whole situation. Paul didn't exist inside the authority. That's another one of those things I asked Mormons. Like, if you can explain to me Paul and his authority, we can talk. But if some dude showed up to the 15 and said, hey, I was out walking in Draper, and I was struck blind, and I saw Jesus, and he said, Frank, why are you kicking against the pricks? You need to be my apostle. And Frank goes to the Big 15 and says, I'm Frank, and Jesus told me that you guys are all wrong. Would they embrace him? Because they didn't embrace Paul either. Peter hated the guy, but Paul's movement was stronger. The bulk of the New Testament is written by or attributed to Paul. You know, we're the mainstream Christian church is a Pauline church. It's not a Petrine church. It's not a Jesus church by any stretch of the imagination. It's based on writings attributed to or written by Paul, Saul of Tarsus. But he came out of nowhere. Mine is a house of order. Like, we learn all this stuff in Mormonism, and it's just like, that's not how it actually works, is it? That's not how it worked in the early Christian church. It's definitely not how it worked when Joseph Smith died with the secession crisis. It wasn't like, oh, well, Joseph died. Well, obviously, the president of the Quorum of the Twelve is the next one. They had no idea. They had debates about it. And sorry. I'm doing that thing again. I just talk and talk, so I apologize. But religion develops the same way everywhere you go. You look at the latest one would be Scientology. If you've looked at Scientology, it followed the same trajectory. You know, L. Ron Hubbard died, and David Miscavige grabbed the reins and ran with it and built something that is entirely different than the original vision of the founding charismatic leader. It happens every time. Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah, that's why you can't say one church is the one true church, because they're all pretty much equally
true. Well, to me, you say they're all equally true, they're all equally absurd, but it exactly. means the same thing.
I said true, but I was thinking other words.
But I don't know. I feel like I've been rambling a bunch and running you on tangents. So
no, I've enjoyed it, actually.
But...
No, so do you feel like you're in a happy space now?
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said,
highs
when,
and lows.
When you're happy, you're wicked happy. When you're sad, you're like, this sucks. And you still have to process all of your feelings and emotions. Like, being ex-Mormon it's a process. And I think you can get stuck in a loop of continually being obsessed with what the church is doing and letting it piss you off and getting angry about it. And you can get caught in that loop, and you can get caught in that loop for years because you were in the other loop for years. You were stuck in a loop of everything the church does is great. No matter what happens, it's awesome. You know, the authorities know what they're doing. Jesus is leading the church. It's really easy to get sucked over into that same loop. I don't feel like I'm in that loop. I didn't have a very long angry phase because it doesn't make sense to me. You know, I pay attention to what the church does because I think it's silly.
Also live in Utah. You can't help.
Well, you know, the whole ordained women thing and how they're barring any reporters from being around for conference. It's silly. That's just silly. The whole situation is silly. Somebody on the ex-Mormon Reddit wrote this, like, parallel story about Dad sent the boys to build a clubhouse, and the boys built a clubhouse, and then the girls wanted to come to the clubhouse, and Dad said, you have to let the girls in the clubhouse. But you know, they named their club the Secret Order of Wizards. And then the boys were doing magic, and the girls wanted to do magic, but the boys said, no, Dad didn't say we had to let you do magic. He just said we had to let you in the clubhouse. And then the girls said, we talked to Dad, and he said that you need to let us do magic. It's like, Dad never told us that. And the girls were like, well, ask Dad. He's like, no, we don't want to. It's like, it's just as silly. It's like, we're casting spells, and we want to cast spells, too. And it's,
you know, I kind of fear what would happen if I actually do sustain the ordained woman, because I think if you're in a... if you want change, you should try.
No, I do, but too.
I also fear what kind of faith crisis could occur if women do get priesthood and they have the laying on of hands and they go, wait, I don't feel any different.
This, like, doesn't work.
Now all I can do is take money for out of tithing envelopes. This is it, yeah. You know. I just fear the crash that may come for these women that are trying so hard.
Well, and it's... I think that organizationally, I don't think the modern church wants it to happen. Mm-hmm. But eventually it gets to be a big enough thing from a social stigma standpoint. I know the church likes to think they're really big. The LDS church, I mean, let's be honest, it's a rink-a-dink little church, you know. It's a speck of dust. It's even if all 15 million members they claim were actively going, which, again, let's be honest, that's not happening. It's still a percentage of the population, you know. That's one thing that I think it's hard to wrap your brain around, especially in Utah, is that the Mormon church doesn't matter that much. it just doesn't. Its influence is not great outside of Utah. You know, maybe it has fingers in Idaho, particularly in Rexburg, but, you know, it can't. This idea that the church is going to be strong enough to take over the government and save the country, the likelihood of that is just, it's just as likely that a public speaking group that I go to that will end up, you know, taking over and running the country, it's just, they're insignificant. And that's a hard thing to wrap your brain around, because when you grow up Mormon, the church is everything. And when you see that the church is just this, it's a Fortune 500 corporation, that's what it is. Its impact on the world isn't from being a church. It's in the businesses it owns. And so from a church standpoint, all the rhetoric that you go with as a believing member, it becomes kind of meaningless, because the church is pretty insignificant when you really look at it on a global scale.
Well, I appreciate the interview. I do. I've enjoyed it a lot. And
thanks.
We talked about highs and lows, and I've definitely felt it during this interview. I mean, I haven't felt any lows. I'm just so
high. Well, it's like I said, feeling like the crazy person is the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're going through this, and it's less and less this way. Like, I can't imagine the people who were going through this in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s before there was support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when all you had were the Tanners and Lighthouse Ministries, and their stuff, while well researched, still has a super hyper Christian bent. And I think for a lot of people who are coming from Mormonism, you
feel burned. You don't want to jump back in.
Well, there's no room for it. You've spent your entire life learning why the LDS Church is right and every other church is wrong. You know. I don't understand people who can go and be like hardcore Christians after they leave the LDS Church. I don't, because of the way I process the world. I know people do, but I don't understand it, because I spent 30 some odd years learning why every other Christian denomination couldn't be right. And then when you learned that, you know, the LDS Church is just as much bunk, it's like, well, where does that leave you? And you could go to the Universalists, but I don't have the time for that. You know, I'd rather hang out with my family on Sunday, to be honest. You know, I've got friends, and I've been fortunate, and I know I've been fortunate that my loved ones and the people around me haven't ostracized me, they haven't removed me from their lives, they haven't treated me remarkably different since I've been through this. And I feel like I'm fortunate that way. And part of that might be that they just don't talk to me about it, and part of it might be that they've decided that they know my reasons for leaving the church. And, you know, if they think I left the church for a certain reason and they're wrong, I don't care. You know, if that's how they have to process life. I have a brother-in-law who says that I was offended. That's how he has to process it. And it's like, well, to some degree, yeah, I was offended. You know, I'm offended at the existence of the corporation at this point. It's not doing what churches do. It doesn't exist in a space where the man Jesus, it's not even in line with what the man Jesus taught. But he's got to process it that way. He can't understand it any other way. He can't understand that I don't believe. You know, I was talking to my sister-in-law, who's just fantastic, last night. And she's like, this is so... She says it's interesting. It's like, so interesting. I never even can imagine a worldview like that. Like, she can't understand, in her life, not believing. You know, she's like, it makes sense, but I don't understand it. And I've appreciated my family in that way, because they've all been really respectful. My kid turned 8 last year, and there was very little pressure to get him baptized. You know, my mother-in-law, who I love, was the only one to kind of try and bring it up with him. But in all honesty, I wanted him to understand what it was. And when he understood, I don't know, not entirely. I don't want him to understand baptism the way I understand baptism. But when he understood what it meant to become a member of the church and what that would entail and what it was expected of him, he opted out. He said, I don't want to do that. You know, he said, I'll wait till I'm 9. And that answer has gotten people to stop asking him. You know, and he doesn't want to go to church. None of my kids want to go to church. We say, you guys want to go to church today? They're like, no. And so it's just like, it makes it easier. But again, like I said, I've got a great family and great friends. And I haven't had the negative experience that a lot of people have had. And I really feel for the people who do, because I think everybody's family should respond at least sort of the way my family did. And that's with, like my sister said, she's like, I love you no matter what. What do you want our relationship to look like now? And I think that ex-Mormons could do themselves a favor and let their family be Mormons. You know, I know that there's, you'll say, oh, I think it's damaging, and I've seen the light, and I want them to see it too. And it's just like, everybody's got their own path. You know, if your family's super Mormon and you're not, and they're letting you not be, let them be. You know, let them give blessings on the food when they come to dinner at your house. You know, do all the normal stuff for them, and they're going to treat you better, in my experience. Because the problem often comes up when you're fighting each other. And I granted, there's somebody listening who's like, not my family. My family's a bunch of assholes. But that might be true. But you don't know unless you're being cool about it too. And I know that you might not think you're being a jerk about it, but a lot of times ex-Mormons are. My house, my rules sort of thing. I don't care. I don't care if people pray in my house. I don't care if people are putting my name on the prayer rolls at the temple. I don't care if they're praying for me. I don't care if they're praying that I'll see the light. You know, I don't even care if they're praying that something bad will happen to me. Because guess what? Prayer doesn't have a great track record. So I'm not worried about it. You know, if that's what they desire for me, it's like, well, that's messed up, but go with God, you know?
Go in peace.
I can't change that. I can't say, how dare you talk to your imaginary friend about hurting me? That's what it's akin to. It's just like, let religious people do what religious people do, as long as it's not screwing with legislation, as long as it's not taking rights away from other people, as long as it's not impacting people's worlds, non-believers' worlds negatively. Do what you're going to do. Although the minute that you start screwing around with people who don't believe the same way you do and trying to legislate their morality, all bets are off. And I'm really verbose and I talk a lot, so people don't like to argue with me. Maybe not because I'm right, but because I just don't shut up.
It's a talent. I wish I had that.
I don't know. It's one of those things that... My wife's a processor and I'm a talker. So I'll talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, and she'll process. And 2 days later, she'll come back with like the most awesome thing, you know, but she's got to process all of that. And me, I just word vomit. I just spew it all out there. Like, take for what you will, you know. One thing I've learned to do, and this I think is helpful too for people who've left or people who are, you know, super liberal in their views. Frame everything you say in your experience. My father-in-law teases me about it. He's like, you say, well, in my experience, and then you go on to talk about what you believe or don't believe. And I think that helps, because the problem, you go to church and everything's black and white. And so then when you leave the church, everything's still black and white. So rather than the church is true, it's then, you know, the church is not true. And that's what creates tension. You sit down with somebody and you say, what you believe is a lie. It's totally different when you sit down and you say, in my experience, I've been through some things, and I've had some experience that you haven't had, and I can't understand your experiences. I know that you've had some experiences. I can't understand those because they're not mine. But in my experience, this is the conclusion I've come to. And that doesn't mean that I think I'm right and you're wrong. It just means this is what works for me right now. That's a lot better than, how can you go to that bullshit church? You know? But the problem is, we're taught to think black and white, and that black and white thinking often crosses over. And you can't be that way with people. You just, not if you want relationships. And I honestly think relationships are all we've got. We've got our relationships in this life, and when that's done, that's it. So be cool. You know? What is it? There's that horrible meme where it's Moses with the tablets and, for the Ten Commandments, but there's just two. One of them is be cool, and the other one's don't be an asshole.
I've seen that one. I like it.
But that, you know, makes as much sense as anything, you know. And you've got to remember, everybody has got to remember that people are processing life in their own way. And we've got to respect that, even when somebody's a jerk. All you can do is try to not be a jerk.
So thank you very much, Keith.
That's not a problem. I did want to say, if anybody listening to this knows me, and if you've heard my story, you know me. I'm not sharing my last name just because I'm still being a little weird about it, but find me. You can find me on Facebook after the start of May. I've been taking a hiatus. Also, you can email me at my first name and my last name, all as one word, at Gmail. So if you know me and you're going through something, and I'm not talking about if you were trying to even find somebody to help you leave, if you want to get pointed at resources to help you stay, that sort of thing, and you need a sounding board, if you just want to talk to somebody, it's so cathartic. So if anybody wants to reach out to me, please do.
And if you'd also like to share a story like Keith, your personal experience, again, email me at voices@mormonexpression.com. And also, I'd like to ask, and I can edit this out if you don't want to,
cool.
But if you have that song or any song that I can drop in at the end, we'd love to hear it.
Which song?
You mentioned a song that you wrote about grief, I think.
Oh, that one. I'll have to see if I've got the recording of that. I switched my studio computer and I lost a few things. Okay. But I definitely have songs that have been reflective of what I've been going through. So if I can't find that one, there's another one that I love. I think everybody else hates it, but it's fine.
Okay.
It's a song that I love, and it's super relative to my entire journey and such. But I'll try and find the one on grief. That's a super simple song. But either way, I can get you something.
Great. I love it. I'm excited. Thank you.
Cool. No problem. Thanks, Katrine.
Thanks.
Days when the world comes crashing down, it seems so strange to wear a smile where should be a frown. The logic ties your hands, you wonder. Demagogue that says it's all right when you throw your hands up at the sky, and it's not the way you thought you wanted your hopes to reconnect. There's pain when you breathe, pain when you know you can't just lay down and admit it's over. Everything's okay.